Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Good morning, Dimitri. Is it even morning there?
It's almost 5 in the evening, but that was that introduction got me all riled up.
Good. That was our rabble rants intro that went on, just glitched out on us there. So yeah, it woke me up, but happy to have you in the studio again, Dimitri. I believe it's your third time, but I'll link all your previous appearances in the show notes for folks. I saw your tweet come across my feed, or maybe it was Instagram, and you were up to some shenanigans. We wanted to talk to you about it. Good shenanigans, all good trouble. And do you want to tell us a little bit about your latest lawsuit? People forget maybe you're also a lawyer and a shit disturber, right? An activist. They see you on YouTube as well, but you do practice law and you're at it again. Tell us about TMU.
Well, if you can't disturb the shit once in a while with the legal mechanisms available to us, then what is the whole point of the legal system?
Yeah, right? Why did you go to school?
Exactly. So the short answer to your question, Jessa, is that we have filed, myself and four other lawyers, it's five of us, from various backgrounds who have agreed to represent 10 current and former students at Toronto Metropolitan University on a pro bono basis in a lawsuit filed last week against the university. These students and former students were all were or are enrolled at the Lincoln Alexander School of Law at Toronto Metropolitan University. And the short explanation of why we sued is that the university smeared them for approximately 2 years as anti-Semites, and did so even after they were cleared of the accusation of anti-Semitism by a retired Chief Justice of Nova Scotia, whom they hired to conduct an external review. It was the judge of their choice, cleared them, and they continued, over the objections of the students who signed the letter in support of Palestinians, to smear them up until the day that we filed our lawsuit, when they suddenly retracted the defamatory statement from the university's website without even having the courtesy to notify us that they were retracting it.
I was going to ask you, you know, I saw an article in Toronto Today. I was reading it, clicked on the link to see, oh, the statement is still up. And sure enough, you know, website cannot be found. So a little bit of movement from the university, but they retracted it, but not really. Like, they just quietly broke the link, right? And there was no admitting of wrongdoing or any clarification put out there. And they were fucking explicit, right? They said there's a letter, right? You did say it was a short answer, so I'll give a few more details. You could take a break. But like, students signed a letter, and I'm not going to read it. I'll link it for folks. 75 students, most of them were anonymous. A lot of folks did put their name to it, but it wasn't like a real radical statement. I mean, it was well worded, but it made some acknowledgments. It was nowhere near anti-Semitic. And the university said it contained sentiments of anti-Semitism and intolerance. Like, that's so explicit to put that out in a public statement. It's one thing, like, we get these quips online all the time. Like, how many times a day are we, like, those accusations thrown at Palestinian solidarity activists? But to have a university administrator put that out publicly, did they not expect somebody would come back and sue them for it?
No, they punch down. That's what these people do. You know, they go after people who don't have the financial capacity to defend their rights in a court of law. And the only reason why these students can is because they found five lawyers who are willing to represent them pro bono. These are students who, you know, we, as I'm sure you know, Jess, in Santiago, you know, nowadays to get a university education, and especially to go all the way to the end of law school, 7 years of university education, you're going to have to spend a ton of money, and you're probably going to end up with a lot of debt, and you're in no position to hire some capable lawyer to represent you in a court of law. And the university understands this. And they thought that these students were just going to lie down and take the beating. And they turned out to be sorely mistaken. Now, there's a really important, I don't know if you recall this, Jessa, but there was a huge controversy surrounding the signing of this letter back in late 2023. And it really is important to understand the context here to appreciate just how appalling the behavior of the university is. So when this letter was signed, it was October 20th, 2023. So this was almost 2 weeks after the attacks of October 7th. By that point in time, even within 2 weeks, Israel had massacred thousands of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip, and far more than Palestinian militants were alleged to have killed on October 7th. The number that the Israelis gave is approximately 800 civilians were killed on that day. Not all of them Israelis, by the way. And there is a serious question about who actually killed all those people. Some were killed by Palestinian militants, but there's a lot of evidence that the Israeli military implemented something called the Hannibal Directive and started just firing wildly to prevent any Israelis from being taken back into Gaza as hostages. There's plenty of evidence that a number of those people were killed by Israeli soldiers. But let's say the number is 800, just for the purposes of argument. Palestinian militants killed them all. By the time you get to October 20th, there had been several thousand Palestinian civilians killed. And not only that, but Israel's most senior leaders had made openly genocidal statements, like President Herzog, Prime Minister Netanyahu, the former defense minister Yoav Gallant. And you don't have to take my word for it that their statements were genocidal. You just have to look at the decision of the International Court of Justice in January 2024, when it said that it was plausible Israel was committing genocide. The court cited the statements that were made in that period between October 7th and October 20th as evidence of Israel's genocidal intent. So our clients, reacting to this, said there's a genocide unfolding, and the law school is making noises that sound more pro-Israel than pro-Palestinian, and this is unacceptable. And they didn't even intend that, by the way, to be for public consumption. Somebody leaked the letter. So the letter gets leaked. And what happens, the worst characters in Ontario's legal profession, and I have no hesitation in saying that they're a disgrace and an embarrassment to the profession, 24 affluent Zionist lawyers signed a letter in which they basically called for the heads of these students on a platter. Their expulsion, they're being blackballed from the legal profession, no employment opportunities, nothing. And one of the persons who led the charge is this scoundrel, I have no hesitation in saying that either, Howard Levitt, who has a column in the National Post, a weekly column, in which, in the Post, he openly called himself, quite apart from the letter he co-signed with these 23 other lawyers, for these students to have their, you know, for their careers to be destroyed. So in that context, the university put out the statement smearing our clients. They were faced with threats of having donations withdrawn, you know, of having members, esteemed members of the bar, refusing to be adjunct professors, you know, to lecture at the university. Their name was being dragged through the mud. And rather than stand up for the students and what is right, they threw the students under the bus. But the judge they chose, Justice McDonald, came to the rescue and after a months-long investigation cleared their names. And even then, the university refused to retract its allegation of anti-Semitism.
I want to read a little bit from the advice that the judge gave to TMU administrators, because I think it's quite telling. I mean, there's a few there's many recommendations that all kind of point to exactly what you're saying. I mean, they worded a little bit differently there, but here, the lawyers who fueled the backlash against the respondent students displayed the same kind of response for which they have criticized the students, using insensitive and harsh words, rushing to judgment, and not acknowledging opposing viewpoints. They have talked about the importance of civility and respectful dialogue without extending those empathetic sentiments to the students involved. We would encourage them, going forward, to apply their experience and wisdom in ways that support LASL students, whether through mentorship opportunities, placement, or long-term positions. I mean, that's the last thing those students probably want from those lawyers. But that was a real kind of fuck you. You're exactly, what is it? Every accusation is an admission, right?
Yeah. That's... He also chastised, you may have seen this, Jessa, the judge also chastised the university for inflicting hardship on the students. You'd think at that point these people would have the basic decency to retract their scurrilous allocation, but they left it up there for another 16 months.
And I know we're talking university students, and I don't doubt that they might be broke, but they're law students. Like when I said, like, didn't they expect this? But not even of law students who had already been advocates. These were people who put their name to a letter in, I know you say the writing was on the wall, but still the very early days of some of the support that was garnered, right? So these were radical law students so you're trying to teach them a lesson, right? $10 million is nothing to sneeze at for a university. Five of it is help me out. Five is punitive. $5 million is punitive, and $5 million is for...
Compensatory. So one is compensation for damages they've sustained, and the other is over and above their compensation. Punitive damages are designed to express the court's strong disapproval of the behavior of the defendant. That's what we call punitive damages. So if they get everything they're asking for, it would come to a total judgment of $10 million plus interest.
Plus interest. Do you think this will serve as a deterrent for this administration, even just the launching of the lawsuit? Because we've seen they've already pulled that website down. Maybe we'll get more movement from them. But is this a strong enough deterrent for them and maybe more universities? Because, you know, students were treated awful, especially for looking back at the summer of 2024 with the student encampments and the demonizing a lot of administrations did for students protesting the genocide. Is this the first lawsuit for defamation against a university?
Since the genocide began in October, a Canadian university, I'm not aware of any other defamation lawsuit having been brought by students. There might have been a defamation lawsuit brought by, I'm not sure about this, but it might have been brought by a professor. I know that there was something like that in the United States. There was a professor of a university who brought a defamation lawsuit. There may have been more than one, but I don't believe that there's been any case during this genocide. I can't even think of any before the genocide where students of a university in Canada sued, pro-Palestinian students, sued the university for defamation. And is this a sufficient amount of money to deter them? Certainly it's an amount of money that'll cause them to stand up and take notice. You know, the sad reality is, Jessa, that our universities today operate like for-profit businesses. And I think that has a lot to do with why they threw the students under the bus, because they were looking at it saying, oh, they're going to withdraw donations and we're going to have other, you know, potential donors be deterred from giving to us. And there's a conflict of interest here because these richly paid administrators of the universities in Canada, their compensation, you know, is indirectly impacted by the amount of donations the university receives. So they're looking after their own selves, I would go so far as to say, when they smear students in order to placate wealthy donors.
That's what you think a lot of their motivation lays? Because like that, I think, is a risky move. You cannot say anything, but they wanted to be clear to like distance themselves from these students to begin with. But they took like that extra step. And the students themselves were protesting the neutrality of it all. And they're like, I love how they're like, oh, we're not neutral. We're clearly Zionist. One of the things that I thought of when I saw the lawsuit, you know, come across my feed was, okay, someone called them anti-Semitic. What is anti-Semitic? what definition are the courts going to be using to determine? I mean, I know the report cleared them, and we know that defending the freedom for Palestine or fighting a genocide is not anti-Semitic. However, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is a big fucking problem. I will link an episode where we kind of really go over exactly why, but you know, most broadly, any criticism of Israel becomes framed as anti-Semitic. Canada adopted this shit in 2019. Now, not legally binding, but we've spoken to movement lawyers who are working cases through the courts, and there's a lot of hate motivation charges and language, and they're not entirely sure what definition of anti-Semitism the courts are using when making decisions. How's that going to play out on your case?
Well, first of all, the judge heard from both Zionist and anti-Zionist members of the Jewish community on this question. And he explicitly states in his report that they raised the Zionist members of the Jewish community who argued that this was anti-Semitic used the IHRA definition. So he's already taken that into account very carefully and gave an opportunity for people who took that position to sit down and talk with him and explain their position. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we have to investigate this a little further, but it may well be that we will take the position in this litigation that the whole question of whether this is anti-Semitic or not is subject to a legal doctrine called res judicata, or its cousin issue estoppel, which means that there was a full airing of that issue in a judicial or quasi-judicial context. TMU had the opportunity to express its view if it so chose. A judge of competent jurisdiction made the decision. And so it's too late. The issue has been decided. And as a matter of law, it cannot be reopened. So that's a position we may well take in this litigation. But let's suppose the judge rejects that
position.
Humor
me, right? Yeah. Pretends you have to deal with the definition.
I welcome the debate over the IHR definition. Bring it on. Bring it on. You want to sit there and explain to a judge why criticism of a state that is committing genocide before the eyes of the world over a two-year period is anti-Semitic? Good luck to you, man. Good luck to you. Wait till we put in the evidence of these baby killers mass murdering Palestinian children with reckless abandon and joy. We'll happily have that debate if we have to have it.
We've done a lot of episodes on the lawfare launched against the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, right? Like open declarations that they will weaponize our legal system to defend the genocide, provide cover for Canada's complicity, criminalize activists, criminalize Palestinians. Is this your way of taking that same legal system and using it to, defend or deter more attacks? Because quite often we feel like we're on the receiving end of lawfare. So I'll say it's nice to see folks using it for good as well. Do you want to comment on that use of lawfare?
Well, the law is both a sword and a shield. And from my perspective, we're using it as a shield, not as a sword. We are massively out-resourced in this fight. Okay, the amount of money that we have at our disposal, I mean, almost nobody in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement can afford to, pay a lawyer to defend themselves. There are people, let's take the case of this, I don't know if you followed this crazy lunatic Zionist, Dahlia Kurtz, who is suing Eve Engler and Roger Waters.
Okay. Oh, she's suing him now. We know that she's, sicked the Montreal police on him.
Yeah. And then the charges that they filed against Eve after they threw him in the Hoosegower for 5 days for no justification whatsoever. It's outrageous. They dropped the charges against him that relate to his condemnations of Dahlia Kurtz. But she then went out and she hired another scoundrel, let me say, Neil Oberman, who ran for the Conservative Party in the last election in Anthony Housefather's rioting and lost. one of the craziest Zionists in the Canadian legal
profession. Zionist versus Zionist. Ooh, what a battle. Yeah,
exactly. He had the audacity to claim that Anthony Housefather was, you know, insufficiently devoted to Israel, and that the Liberal Party had a Hamas wing. That's what he said. The Liberal Party had a Hamas wing. Just crazy stuff. Anyways, this guy is now representing Dalia Kurtz in a lawsuit against Roger Waters and Eve Engler for defamation. Now, I don't know what his arrangement is with her, but I would be very surprised if Neil Oberman is doing that for free. He certainly hasn't come out and said, to my knowledge, that he's doing it pro bono. Somebody's paying him. And there's another law firm called Diamond and Diamond, which is running around the country filing class action lawsuits against universities.
I've heard their commercials.
Yes, yeah. And by the way, these guys are like, again, I've had it with the legal profession in Canada, so I'm not pulling any punches anymore.
Clearly.
Let me just say, Jessa, that all my comments on the legal profession during this broadcast, I should have said at the outset, are on my own behalf. I'm not speaking on behalf of my clients, okay?
Any of them.
They may or may not agree with me. I'm not telling you they don't agree with me. I'm not telling you they do agree with me. I'm just saying I haven't sought their authorization to say these things. So I'm expressing my personal opinion here, okay? Diamond and Diamond are a bunch of ambulance chasers. I knew them from when I was doing class actions law. They do not have a good reputation. They have a very bad reputation. I really doubt that they're doing that pro bono. They're running around the country filing class actions against universities, making these scurrilous allegations that they've created an unsafe environment for Jewish students. The unsafe environment, to the extent it exists on university campuses today, it's an unsafe environment for those who advocate, including members of the Jewish community, for those who advocate for Palestinians. That's where the real unsafety lies, in my opinion. But in any event, who's paying all these lawyers? And I can give you plenty of other examples where there is litigation. So they are waging lawfare against us. And whenever we can, and we have to be strategic about it because our resources are so much more limited, we fight back and use the law as a shield. And that's the way we view this litigation. We're defending the reputations and honor of these students.
Well, you say, you know, you have to be careful with your resources, because if you sued everybody that called a Palestinian solidarity activist anti-Semitic, you would be a very busy lawyer. You would need a lot more friends working pro bono. So I guess, are we hoping that this isn't just a deterrent for TMU, that, you know, when we do strategically strike back and loud enough and hopefully successfully enough, that it will quell some of these attacks? Not even just the online ones, but perhaps the return lawsuits, and make them question their lawfare? Or, you know, do they have blinders on as well and they're just plowing straight ahead no matter what?
No, I think this litigation is an earthquake in the academic community in Canada. I have no evidence to back that up, by the way. Okay? But just, I'm just going here on my own gut.
We're going to manifest it then.
We'll see. But I'm going here on my own gut instincts about, you know, based upon my interaction with, you know, people in the academic community and my sense of what they, you know, what their calculus is in situations such as this. If they get a bad precedent in this case, if the court actually rules in favor of our clients, even if there's a preliminary determination, they're going to be extremely worried about the floodgates having been opened up, and that other students who've been silent, who haven't had the wherewithal to come forward, will actually then begin to vindicate their rights, and they're going to just be completely inundated with litigation. I think that that's their concern. I would be very surprised if it isn't. And so this has the potential to be a game changer, depending upon how the litigation unfolds. We'll have to see.
Will they want this to go away quietly?
Oh, I would be very surprised if they don't try to make this go away quietly.
Will you let them get away with letting it go away quietly?
Well, that's up to our clients. And that's not a decision. We've had no communication with the university. Like I said, they deleted this scurrilous statement without even notifying us. So I have no idea, you know, what litigation posture they could come to us. It's possible to come to us very quickly and say, we want to get rid of this thing. It's possible to fight us tooth and nail to the bitter end. It's possible that we'll have to, you know, mix it up for a couple of years and then there'll be a settlement. But I wouldn't be surprised if they try to get rid of it quickly. You know, and I want to say one other thing from personal experience, Jess, and that is that I myself had to sue B'nai B'rith for calling me a supporter of terrorism. And that litigation was settled. I'm limited by the terms of the settlement in terms of what I can say of the settlement, but they basically retracted what they said about me, and there was a monetary payment from them, from their insurer to me. And since then, I have not been smeared by a major pro-Israel lobby group. I can't think of one time, not one occasion. That was 3 years ago. And I used to get, you know, weekly smears directed at me by the major pro-Israel lobby groups. And now it's zip. So I think that they, you know, they realized they were dealing with somebody who is prepared to vindicate his rights in a court of law. And I think that that's something that may well happen here in the case of TMU and the universities in general.
Well, I hope specifically the academic community is paying attention, you know, whether it goes away now or not, however it unfolds, it's still going to set a precedent, right? That people fought back and forced a response when that was something a lot of the universities refused to give, right? They refused to disclose, they refused to really give these student protesters any kind of legitimacy, even though, you know, they even tried to pretend they were coming from off campus and all of that. So, you know, we know that the students aren't done mobilizing within those spaces. So anything that we can do to protect them from future attacks, from universities just or administrators going unhinged statements and, you know, sicking the police on them and whatnot for, you know, making unsafe spaces. So, you know, yeah, no matter how the dust settles, Dimitri, it'll have an impact. Yeah. So you might not have evidence, but, you know, surely it's going to have an impact. Yeah. Santiago, I see you unmuted yourself, brother. Join the conversation.
So you mentioned attacks and, you know, Dimitri, you're talking about like unsafe environment on campus. It has to be mentioned that like just a couple weeks ago, there was that incident at TMU where a security guard was body slamming a young Palestinian protester who was taking place in a protest. They pinned them on the ground and dragged them out, an incredibly excessive use of force for what was going on there, right? So it's not like when we talk about like an unsafe environment on campus, it's entirely being created against and resorting to physical violence at this point against the pro-Palestinian students.
Yeah, and if you remember back when they started dismantling these encampments, there was also a considerable amount of brutality used by the police. I think it was at the University of Calgary. I'm pretty sure it was Calgary to dismantle that encampment. Just gratuitous violence. Nobody was seriously injured, as I recall, but they were beating people up, you know. And now you have vigilante groups roaming, you know, Zionist vigilantes roaming some of the university campuses in this country. You know, we were involved in a case involving York University a few years ago, where we persuaded with considerable effort the university to ban Mayor Weinstein, the former Canadian branch of the Jewish Defense League. That took a lot of work for him to be banned. But the fact that he was banned was an implicit acknowledgement that he was a threat to the students on campus.
And he used to show up like a thug to all of our protests at York with other, you know, JDL. They would wear their insignia. They would just stand. They blocked us in the lunch area, you know, like the student center where you eat. They actually blocked the doors with those thugs one time, and still the university, it took Dimitri doing what he did. They didn't even see that part as a threat. So thank you for that. Thank you very much for that. Santiago brings up a good point, like that violence and the violence that you described, Dimitri. It's statements like the one that you are challenging that pave way for that, right? Which frame anything Palestinian as inherently violent and dangerous. And so, you know, putting a lid on that will certainly assist in how universities start approaching, in general, Palestinian protests, right? Because they're going to continue. We're coming up on the anniversary, 2-year anniversary, and the work is clearly not done. So, yeah, like, I'm sure there's a few more. There were injuries at the University of Calgary, by the way. We had Jeremy Appel on to talk about that. There was 2 injuries. I think one person was sent to hospital, but there's a lot of administrators out there or professors or people of power that have labeled students wrongfully. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing those floodgates open. I'm sure you are.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we have a big motion coming up in another case, which I just want to alert your audience to. And that is last year, 7 of us from across the country, 7 lawyers brought a case against the Canadian government, alleging that the Canadian government is violating the Genocide Convention. So that was in November. So the Attorney General has filed a motion to dismiss our case, claiming that we are raising, in essence, they're claiming that we are raising political questions that are beyond the competence of courts to decide. So this is a doctrine, they call it the political question doctrine, which has been used to knock out similar litigation in the United States and Britain. So the entire litigation is at stake, and we're going to be arguing that motion in Ottawa on November 27th. Yeah.
Well, folks will have to stay tuned to your pages to kind of get those kind of updates. Is there ways they can apply pressure before that?
Well, to continue doing what you're doing. I mean, and, you know, tell the Canadian government that you are fed up with its complicity in this genocide and demand concrete action. Above all, a legal prohibition backed up by criminal penalties on the transfer of military equipment to Israel and the purchase of military equipment from Israel. That should be a no-brainer. And whatever the government's telling you, they haven't done that. They continue shipping weapons to Israel. That should be the number one priority of this Palestinian solidarity movement in this country. And more broadly, economic sanctions, you know, the rupture of diplomatic relations, suspension of the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, demand concrete action by your government, because so far it's just nothing but hot air.
Yeah, I mean, folks listening here will have just heard from Musquassin aboard one of the Freedom Flotilla ships, just completely pissed off and fed up that citizens are having to do the government's work. You know, we can call on the politicians to do it, but we're finding out, in essence, it's up to us in the end anyway. But on your November 27th hearing, I find it real rich that the Canadian government is arguing that genocide is just political. It's defined politically, and their involvement or not is defined politically, you know, so like up into the air for interpretation based on who's in power. Like, that's their argument, that there's no legal framework around genocide. I hope the judge sees that for what it is. I will be watching. I will be watching for that, because that I do remember, and I am sorry I forgot to ask you about that as a follow-up, because that's a pivotal case. The obligation not to just contribute to a genocide, but there's actually a legal obligation to prevent it as well. So getting that on the record, and what would the outcome be should you be successful in that case? Like, let's say it went through its entirety. What would be a successful outcome to you?
Well, we're simply asking for a declaration that Canada has violated its obligation to prevent and punish genocide under the Genocide Convention, which is a quintessentially legal question, no doubt about it. I call the political question doctrine the hot potato doctrine. It's basically what they're dressing it up in fancy language, but what they're basically saying to the judges, this is a hot potato, don't touch it. You know, that's really all it amounts to at the end of the day. But we would get a declaration. We're not asking for damages. We're not asking for, you know, mandatory relief. But a declaration that Canada's government, in our view, is violating the Genocide Convention would be devastating to the reputation of this government.
And would have further legal implications, I'm guessing. I'm hoping, right? Right? Like, that would open the way for a lot more.
Absolutely. For many people, not just our clients.
So to be fair, we understand their hesitancy to declare themselves in breach of the laws around genocide.
And they don't want us to get to discovery adjusted because we're going to find out about all the shenanigans they've been pulling when it comes to shipping weapons to Israel, all the lies they've been telling about that. We're going to find out about potentially communications with Israeli government officials, military officials that they've kept under wraps. So I think they are desperately trying to avoid discovery.
I bet. Because I'm very interested in what you can pull out of discovery. I'm sure we don't get to find out, right, during the discovery phase. Or can you share that should it get to that phase?
If the evidence is filed in court in connection with a motion or the trial, then you are entitled to it.
Oh, well, I look forward. I'm going to call you. you call me when you get that discovery, because I want to know it. The best of luck to you, Dimitri. I very much appreciate taking the time. That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Halu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content, and if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.